Okay, great. As I was saying before, we do these informal presentations every other week. We're going to be doing another one just before the all-grantee meeting, which is today, and then we'll do one right after the all-grantee meeting. And we send out post-session notes. The next one will be on August 15th. And what we're going to talk today about is all about critical issues involved with these environmental workforce programs. And then after the all-grantee meeting, and I'll explain what that is, on next week, on August 15th, we're going to be talking about what happened there, because some of you will be able to go and some won't. So we're going to try to bring the highlights and what was discussed at the all-grantee meeting. We convene every year about the beginning of August. These are PLC members, which you all are participating in. It's also grantees, new and old, and alumni. And we bring together all of the regional coordinators. We bring together people from headquarters that are responsible for this program and their bosses. And so we assemble about 140 people, and we do some plenaries where we all get together and discuss things with panels. And then we do breakouts where we try to get one-on-one discussions, and we talk about best practices and strategies. And I'm going to get into that in a second. Is Heather on the line? Is Heather joining?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Heather. We always start these off. And Heather, we are recording, so I sometimes forget that. I'm not using Skype because I tried to upgrade it just before the call, and that was a mistake. So I'm calling from my cell phone, which is another nice feature of this. Anyone could call in. We've had people call in one of our presenters, Al from Oakland, California. He called in on Highway 5, and I said, please, Art, move over and pull over before you do your presentation. So he did, and everything worked well. But we do these, and as I was saying before the call, we alternate between more instructional presentations and then also grantees talking about what they're doing and what they found works, what they found does not work. So that's always a challenge. So, Heather, why don't you give us the news from Washington as you see it right now?
Well, this is going to be pretty short and sweet. Right now, there's really nothing too new from HQ. And on the HMTRI side of things, we're just really looking forward to the all-grantee meeting next week and have been busy preparing for that side of stuff. So for those of you that are attending, we will see some of the HQ personnel at the all-grantee meeting, and they might talk to us there, and then we will share the information as we move along, especially on the next PLC, as Mike mentioned, that we'll be disseminating some of the information that we gained from the all-grantee meeting.
Well, thank you. Heather is one of our cohorts, and I think she's calling from the road also. So, but that's okay. That's great. And we'll, those of you who are attending, we'll see you all next Tuesday. Wednesday and Thursday are going to be power days. We're going to be doing all the things I was talking about and breaking out into sessions, networking, and doing all of these things. For those who can't go or it's a little too late already, we'll hopefully be looking forward to the next time. But the PLC calls will address a lot of the issues that we're talking about at the conference. So I don't think you'll miss too much. We're going to be discussing those issues, and we're going to be having the presenters on the call. So you can pick up the same content by tuning into the PLC. Now, if everyone who's on our participant list gets they'll get reminders, sometimes too many. We usually send them out Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then, more importantly, you get post-session notes. So if you may not think that you're on the PLC list, if you didn't get a note from me, msenyu@gmail.com, just send me your contact information. We'll make sure you're on that list so you'll get the post-session notes. Post-session notes has all the content in the text form, and those are posted on our website. And Brownfields-toolbox.org. But my email address is msenyu@gmail.com, and that is spelled M as in Michael, S as in Sam, E as in Emily, N as in Nancy, E as in Emily, W as walk. So msenyu@gmail.com. And we'll make sure you're on the list. If someone suggested, hey, maybe you ought to get on this call, just send me that contact information so we can make sure you're getting post-session notes. Well, today we're going to talk about critical issues, and these also, all of this stuff will be in the notes, critical issues for environmental workforce development and job training programs. We've been doing this since the beginning of the program, and we've done a lot of networking and a lot of working with communities who wanted to start an environmental workforce program. We have the privilege of seeing into all these different programs and finding out what seems to be working and when they're having problems, when things are going well for them. And over the years, we've developed a set of critical issues. There's eight of them. And these critical issues are something that we've observed that all of the successful and sustainable programs seem to address, and in different ways, but they all address them. And once we identify the critical issues for sustainable and successful programs, we started digging into each of these, and we set up best practices. Within each of these sustainable critical issues, there are practices that seem to work better than others, and what other some people do and other people don't. And I'll give you an example. When you're doing recruitment, for example, you might be talking about drug testing. We're going to be addressing this very extensively in the all-grantee meeting. There are some people that find that they need to drug test severely before they bring someone into a program. There's as a criteria for recruitment. There are some people who bring people into the program and tell them that you've got to clean up your act and we're going to be doing random tests. There's some people who say we're not going to do that. Some have rehabilitation programs. Some say if you want to be employed, they're going to be doing random testing. And it's your responsibility to clean up. So the critical issue here would be recruitment and placement, but then your best practices can vary from location to location. A good example is we have a grantee who works with Los Alamos, very strict. They won't take ex-offenders. Drug issues are major. These are all disqualifiers. So now you have to ask the question, do I have to incorporate that in my recruitment process before I can't recruit people who that can't get a job at the end of the program? So these are, I'm kind of illustrating one example of a best practice under a critical issue. So I'm gonna go through these critical issues, and I go from one to eight. But I want you to keep in mind that when you start developing the program, and as we go through these PLCs over the next 9 or 10 calls, we always recommend people work backwards. And you'll see this in a minute. The last one, and I'll tell you why, the last one is program sustainability. That means keeping your program going, whether or not you get federal funds, where you can get funds from other places, and how you can, once develop your program, let that rocket fly. That's number eight. And right behind that is placement and tracking. And we have to keep in mind, if there's one mantra to this program, it's placement and tracking. That means placing your graduates, hopefully 100%, which some of our grantees have done, certainly more than 70%. This program has a luxury of if you do other things properly, they will be looking for your grantee, your graduates, because the certifications and training you give them, we've heard anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000 of value for the OSHA certs and the EPA certs and all of the things that your students will learn. So among many training programs, this is more of a technical one. Your graduates often are in demand if the programs run right. So we always keep in mind the whole program is focused on placement. And of course, the tracking comes in as we never, and many of our programs never let go of their graduates. They're graduates forever. And again, interestingly enough, at our all grantee meeting, we're going to have an individual who graduated from a program, was placed, got a great job, elevated himself to the point of he was hiring other people. He became a supervisor and hired other people. And because of changes in the organization, he was downsized. And, of course, now he's looking for a new position. But the program and grantee never let them go, and they're working with him to get to the position he left, which is in a supervisory role. So that's an example of what our programs do in terms of placement and tracking, but that is the main focus. So given that background, I'm going to go through these, and we're going to talk about each of these in detail as these PLCs progress, but I want to give you at this early stage, this is only the second PLC, where we're kind of going in terms of what programs have to do. Many of you who already have programs may have all of these already in place. You may have some of them, you may have none of them. But as we go, we'll try to beef your program up if you're interested in going to the next step. So anyway, the first one is community and labor market assessments. I have to keep myself from saying this is the most important critical issue of the whole group. They're all important. The most important one, obviously, is number 7, placement and tracking. But these are all very, and that's why we call them critical issues. If you don't assess your labor market and your community properly, you're doomed to failure. You won't work. The community assessment is extremely important. And this is, where are you going to place your training program? And there's lots of considerations that go into this, and I'm just going to touch on a few, and then we're going to go to the next critical issue so we don't try to go over our half hour. You want to find the neighborhood that is welcoming you, that have strong neighborhood ties. You also combine it with the labor market assessment, and this is something that some of our grantees overlook. You could find an environmental justice neighborhood. They need the work. You've got a lot of support from the community. But you've got to consider when these people graduate, when community residents graduate, where are they going to work? How can they get to work? Can they really sustain their employment? For example, if we're on the west side of Chicago and we've got a great neighborhood there, you do some tremendous training. You're in what I call an employer desert. We all hear about food deserts. This is an employer desert. There are no businesses on the west side of Chicago. They have all moved out. Well, you've got this great program. You run through it. Your graduates are there. And you may or may not have a good transportation network, which is what you've got to evaluate. Your students may or may not have cars. They've got to drive out to Des Plaines, or they have to drive out to one of the suburbs that's 17 miles away to get employment. And maybe they'll get a job, but then they're going to be able to stay in that job. So we're combining the community assessment with the labor market assessment. And, of course, that second half is extremely important. You've almost got to get your employers lined up before you even start writing your grant. You really have to have them on your side because they will play an important role as we go through all these other critical issues. So before you even start, and even many of you who are in that beginning stages, you can sit back even now and think, okay, what community do I have? And how close, we've got people in Louisiana, how close am I to maybe some refineries? Am I in a employer desert? Is there a labor market here? Is there a community where the churches will support us, where people will join in even things like gangs in some urban areas? Are we going to have a problem with neighboring gangs, or is there such a high level of violence that we're not going to be successful in retaining our students. So this is what we talk about when we talk about community labor market assessments. And again, we're going to talk about these in detail later. The second one is building partnerships. This grant, an EPA grant, is only $200,000 over two power years and then a follow-up year, so 3 years over $200,000. For labor training programs, this is rounding errors often. The youth program is extremely efficient. It was designed to be efficient. It's an EPA program focusing on environmental issues and environmental cleanup. So it's designed for you to get partners to leverage. It's all about leveraging in the application. Leveraging is everywhere. How are you leveraging? Who are you leveraging with? You've got fiscal partners who may be giving you some money. You've got a lot of in-kind partners who are giving you people, their support services, and WIBs. WIBs are the heroes for our grantees. WIBs are the workforce investment boards, the wheel of legislation, ETA money that comes from Washington, and they're designed to provide support, training, child care, everything, even transportation, all sorts of things. They could provide boots and working work materials that are necessary to do the job, and again, you need to qualify your students. But these are all sorts of partnerships. Another very important partnership is, besides employers, are your advisory boards that you're going to be setting up. So number two, once you start thinking about this and thinking about communities, you've got to start thinking about your partners. Your partners may even be larger organizations. We call it kind of a hookup. I compare it to a freight train. If you try to build a whole railroad, it's tough. You need a lot of money. We suggest sometimes, and sometimes people who weren't successful in one grant review year, maybe they'll look at some partners and maybe just add a caboose onto that train that's already rolling down the tracks. And what that gives you is this tremendous amount of leverage, which brings us into our third critical issue. The train's already going down the track. The infrastructure is there. The finance is there. The training facilities are there. The instructors may be there. All the administrative is there. You may want to think, rather than going this alone in those early stages, is maybe we should hook up with Goodwill. Maybe we should hook up with Jobs for Youth. Maybe there's a myriad of organizations. Some of our most successful programs are youth build programs. They secure money from Department of Labor. But what they do is they approach these well-funded traditional organizations, and they say, would you be interested in expanding your program to include environmental remediation? And we can do that. And here what you're doing is, what can you give to the pot and what can we add to you, which is basically a whole cadre of environmental training courses. And you can provide us with some leverage, help, maybe life skills leveraged, recruitment services, testing services, all of those things. So that building partnerships blends into this leveraging from your state and local. We get tremendous leverage from many state organizations, many from philanthropic organizations. So you can't do this program alone. You might be able to get the grant and you can get started, but you can't sustain yourself. You have to keep in mind too that this program is awarded, you can re-up, I call it. You could reapply, but usually there's 17 or 18 awards, and there might be 50 or 60 people that are applying for grants. So some people are re-upped and some aren't. And when you're not, you need to be able to sustain yourself. And that's the last issue where you talked in the critical issues. But you need to be able to maybe ride out a couple of years. Maybe you need to, and if you're hooked up to a larger organization that's helping you and you've got all kinds of synergies, this could get you through difficult times. And we've had many organizations over the years who have not been funded by EPA, but they kept their program, came back into it. maybe miss a year. So come came and go. We've had some that just didn't need the funding anymore, and we kind of lose track of them because they're doing just fine. So they don't need the federal money. So leveraging, you're gonna need leveraging, and that's again. For those of you in the early stages of this, just keep these things in the back of your mind for now. Student recruitment and screening and assessment is the next one, the critical issue. We talked about getting to know the labor market and the community, and those really blend into student recruitment, screening, and assessment. The biggest problem we have when we see a program fail is that first year, they're so enthusiastic about building their class that they don't look at quality. They look at quantity. Now, this program is environmental justice related. We're supposed to help those who are underserved, need the help, unemployed or underemployed. But the other thing is they have to be successful. You do not. And this is a tough decision. You want to let everyone in, but you can only bring in about 20 people in each cohort. You might have three cohorts of 20, something like that. We've had people have as many as 100. But you've got to be able to place that person. And I posed the example before. If you're working for a national lab and they're the only employer in the town, you could speak out other employers, but they will not hire ex-offenders. This is a horrible thing to say, but you can't recruit ex-offenders. You've got to find other deserving people. You've only got 20 seats, and the key is the most deserving and placeable people. We don't want to pull the cream off the community, but at the same time, we don't want to train someone, make promises, and there's no future for them. So this is critical. And later dates, we're going to be talking about all kinds of testing methods, who you should be looking for, what type of people, issues, and when we talk about the best practices under these critical issues. The next one is interesting. Developing a curriculum and training. You would think this is an environmental workforce development job training program. It is. But we have one critical issue that actually involved environmental training and curriculum. But it is critical. This is all about environmental remediation. And these are skills you can't get anywhere else. And the whole justification, I think, for having this in EPA is that no other agency does this. And it's so specific to environmental cleanup. It's very hard to find standard job descriptions for environmental positions. If you look at the federal guides for put out by the Department of Labor for environmental positions, there's a big hole. There's not a lot. There is no federal money. The program was started because there was no other program in existence. This was the only one that addresses it, and very specifically, it addresses EJ and it addresses environmental remediation. There is another program out there that we'll have at our conference, the NIHS program, but that's health and safety. They talk about environmental remediation and they teach it, but that is funded by Department of Labor to help protect the health of workers. So it's a little different than the EPA program. EPA is pure environmental remediation. So there is a whole cadre of courses we have identified, and again, we'll be talking about those later. But there is a whole host of courses, one mandatory, which is HAZWOP, 1910-120. It's an OSHA course. But there's about four or five others that are very closely related, and there's EPA courses like lead and asbestos, and there's some OSHA courses like confined space and general construction. It's called OSHA 10. But that's highly dependent on where your community is and what type of courses they need. We had one example of a tank manufacturer on the West Coast. We'll hire everyone you could graduate, but these are the courses they need. So, okay, we can live with that, and we'll do the courses that address your issues. Or we have a national lab, and we're working with these particular hazardous materials. Or we're in an urban community, and most of it was developed before 1976 or so, and we got lead everywhere. We got asbestos everywhere. Or we've got schools. We've got a real problem. Or we're in hurricane zones. We have problems with spills, disaster site remediation, all sorts of problems with hazardous materials and qualifying people to work on these sites. So that becomes highly dependent on your location. And again, when we get into best practices, we talk about those specific. Also about curriculum delivery and about finding certified trainers. Those are all part of it, and including safety and health in the classroom. So that it is a very important critical issue and pertains directly to this program as far as training people to do environmental jobs. As I said before, the certifications they get could be worth $5,000-$6,000. And so, again, it makes them, if everything else is done right, it makes them highly desirable. Particularly, those of you in Louisiana, when Katrina hit, all of our grantees, didn't matter where you were, they were hiring. If they said, well, they haven't completed the program. Well, they don't care. Do they have HAZWOP? We want them down here. Can you put them on a sabbatical? We'll hire them, put them up, pay them top dollar. We've got to have the HAZWOP. They got to have HAZWOP. The same thing happened with the fires. Now, this is the floods. This will happen with floods and the fires in California, Northern California. We had two grantees who graduated all their students early. They presented, three of them, LA Conservation Corps. There was and two up north. They all could place, well, there might have been one more, Hunter's Point. They were crying for anyone with the HAZWOP. They said, could you send us your students, whether you put them on sabbatical or you graduate them? And they all had 100% placements. So, again, it depends on local disasters, what's happening. And they also depends on what kind of skills you give them and certifications. So we go to number six, which is another critical issue, is life skills, remedial training, support services, and student retention. And many of you who have programs already and want to start an environmental program are familiar with these. Obviously, your graduates have to have the life skills, whether it's financial literacy. They may have personal and legal issues. They may have transportation problems. They may need child or dependent care. These, unfortunately, are not sponsored or funded by EPA. Everything I've talked to date, up until this critical issue number six, EPA would sponsor activities in those areas. Because it's an EPA program and not a Department of Labor program, they or an HHS program, they require the grantees to leverage that training. You would think that's going to be a problem, but it's not. Most of our grantees partner with Health and Human Services, with WIBS, with banks even for financial literacy, and they seem to not have real issues in terms of leveraging and partnerships to deliver these. We have programs that provide child care. We have grantees that provide transportation with bus programs, free bus passes. Once we had a car dealer that was giving discounts to students. So there's lots of options to investigate there. So number seven is, of course, the whole key, placement and tracking, which I started talking in the beginning. And again, when you start developing these programs, you kind of work backwards and then go back and forth. But you've got to be able to place your students. And maybe now, after this 20-minute discussion, you maybe see why we had to go through those other critical issues to get where we're at. You can't place students that have life skills problems. They obviously have to have the EPA certifications for cleanup. They've got to be sustainable and be able to stay in the job. They have to, if they have social issues, anger issues, they will not be sustainable students. So, and really the reason this program was started was this number seven, placement and tracking, all about getting your students placed. And not only that, the the right student for the right place. Now, there's some differences between grantees. Some programs, especially labor program, they'll train people and then they go out and get a job. This program, there's a responsibility on the grantee. You just don't train them and say, congratulations, here's some people you may want to see, goodbye. That's not this course, this program. There is a responsibility not only to place them, but to kind of follow up the best you can with these. Keep them, as I said, a lot of people use Facebook or LinkedIn. They keep their communities together. Not only that, is a lot of the people that go out, like the gentleman I talked about earlier, they'll go out and they'll start hiring people. They'll work their way up into a position, and then they'll be hiring your other graduates, and they'll be advocating your program. So they become partners, they become instructors, they become advocates, they become mentors. So this placement and tracking is really a critical issue. The last one is what we started out with, is program sustainability. We're also all interested is if we have something that's really good, we want to keep it going. And the whole idea of a 2 to 3 year program kind of turns you off because I want to ramp up and then you're going to cut me off. But we have to remember there's only limited funds in this program, and there are people that are really good, and there's people that get started and they realize they shouldn't be in this. So you have to, when you get the first day, when you start thinking of this, doing your community and labor market assessments, do we have some angels in this community? Or can we get them? Can we develop our program so that the state will fund us, the city, the WIB, or can we meld into another program so we can keep this on? There's no sense in applying for a grant when you know after the grant's gone, you dry up like a little shrimp or something. You want to design from the very beginning an ongoing program. And as I said, most of our programs are able to do that. Some aren't, and some go away when the funding dries up and then comes back. But that's something that we consider critical issues. So I usually don't like to do the talking for the whole time, but these early sessions, this one and probably the next one when we talk about, we'll probably dig more into some of these presentations at the all-grantee meeting. We'll start digging into the best practices that each of these. But I wanted to give all the PLC people an idea of what you're getting into and what I call them landmines, or what the critical issues are. And we found that when everyone does this, everyone does things differently. That's the beauty of the program, depending on your community. But we find they all kind of fit into these 8 categories. And so if they address these 8 critical issues, and then they go into the best practices and then customize their program, they're usually okay. If they don't address these critical issues, we usually find that they have problems. For one reason or another. So that was a lot in a short period of time, but two things. Does anyone have any questions about what I just talked about? And then second, are there some questions you have about the program? We're going to be at this all-grantee meeting. We're going to see regional coordinators. We're going to see administrators. And are there some general questions you might have about this program that we may be able to help with? Anything out there? Okay.
Yes, this is Hilbrana Wright. My question is this. We're definitely considering what our program would look like. We talked about an apprenticeship, as Mr. Pat Garden from the South Central Planning Commission spoke on. We're working together on a redevelopment project that will house potentially some incubators and business training centers in the downtown Houma area. Our preliminary preparation for what that would develop into is to look into doing a pilot program on some other projects that we're working on that would partner to lead to some apprenticeship in the construction area. And definitely being able to certify and have some certifications in the environmental area, especially being in Louisiana, you know, that is a great area for disaster recovery and resiliency planning. And so some of the things that we've been looking into is how we can implement maybe a first phase of just kind of seeing how the program would work. And my question is to you, have there been any programs that you can point to that have kind of started off a little small in the area of construction base and added that element of environmental to it as a supplement?
Yes, and many. I want to point out a couple. They're totally different examples, but coal fields. We're in West Virginia. No jobs, no employers. They started from scratch. Exactly, they started an incubator, just what you're talking about. They started looking for money in all kinds of things. In fact, they make their own T-shirts. I get. They have a website, and they're selling T-shirts. They're making frames from recycled mine shaft wood. They've got EPA programs going. They've got re-upped. They're combining all of their different things that they have, and they form for-profit and non-profit organizations and community development projects. And they've banded together, just as you're talking about doing. And they're putting it all into, I don't want to say putting it into a wall pot. They don't duplicate fund. You can't duplicate federal programs or federal funding. But they're putting them all, just like that train I talked about. They're adding cars one by one. None of these programs would work if they just did the one. But together they're working well. Another one is our shooting star is out in Oakland. Art Shanks started this program 20 years ago. It was a construction program. It was when they had their Yubelinda earthquake. The bridge fell down. Bridge fell down, and it was less than a mile from a training center that they had with some other program. They have flourished. They went on to get a youth build grant from Department of Labor. They've got tons of local money. They started apprenticeships with organized labor. They just expanded to something like, I want to say, an 80,000 or 100,000 square foot facility. They build houses in their facility. They've got all kinds of training. Art has been recognized by the White House for what he's done to that community and jobs in this community. Again, exactly what you're talking about. Now, he's had a jump on you. He's had 20 years ahead of you, but he would be an inspiration. But there are many like that. I mean, these are just two that came off the top of my head. What I would say is, at this point and where you're at, is start looking at partnerships, because you're not going to be able to do it alone. And so as you start talking at these early stages, start thinking who you can combine. Check out Goodwill. Check out the construction trades. This works well with construction because, in fact, some of our courses, OSHA 10, is general construction because it's health and safety and environment. And so what he does is he has a youth build program. They teach construction trades, but then they take the pick of the litter, those who want to go into environmental. They go through the construction program, and then they go into the environmental program after that. Now you're talking about someone that's supercharged as far as an employee. And by the way, I think he places about 100% of his people. He also tracks them. They're always part of the organization. Art even goes in front of, with people with legal issues, he goes in front of the judge to help them out. So this is an outstanding program. We're going to, in our PLCs, after we get through the next one, we'll have Eric Shanks on to talk about his program and what they're doing.
Okay. When is the we do have our I do have Ms. Rita did call me on yesterday, and I was able to get a call into my president of the organization and also one of our general contractors that is working on developing the pilot program with us. He's out of Lafayette, Louisiana. Fred Turner is also on the call, so I know he's benefiting from hearing the information that you're giving. But also, we wanted to know, when was the first round of, or the next round of these grants going to be available?
Okay, this is the $200,000 question for all of us. There's budget issues, and you know, I think that Rita may have as much information as I do. We've heard different stories, and we're hoping for an angel to step in. Normally, it's in November, and then it's awarded in April, but there was a budget deal that had to be made. This is all, it's not official or anything. You know, it's a story. We're not sure, but I think this is the way it may be. What we may do is, what they may do is fund it in spring, and actually the money would, the checks would be written in like October 1 and of next year. That may be the case, or we may get some in last minute. Hey, we found some money. So, Rita, do you want to add anything beyond what I just said? She may not be on the call. Okay. But that's basically where we're at. It's not going to happen before November when it usually happens. It may get stretched out till spring. But I may have the answer for you in 2 weeks or in 15.
Mm-hmm. So. I'm familiar with EPA, so I know.
Yep. We're... You know, it's all open right now.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
One thing I have to say, they're supporting these programs. It's not that we hate this program. Their Brownfields program is huge, and it's a great urban development program. So, anybody else? Okay. Any questions? Sometimes we do go a little longer, but these are great. When people have questions, they're great. Okay. Well, if we don't see you at the All Grantee meeting, hopefully we'll see you on the 15th, and make sure you get us your contact information so we can make sure you're on the list. We'll go from there.
All right.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.